Good afternoon. So, last time, we talked about hardware we used to store data persistently. We started with hard drives, not because they're necessarily still the most popular, but because their history is that they were what motivated our file systems. And also what motivated solid-state disks. And hard drives had these physical limitations because they were built on physically spinning disks, and we had to wait for the piece of the hardware that read or wrote from those disks to get to the right part of the disk. And we had this seek time for it to get to the right distance from the edge of the disk, and rotational latency waiting for the disk to spin and reach the right part under it. And we learned that these were sort of on the order of milliseconds. We also learned that hard drives aren't super reliable, and one of the ways that I deal with that is that the controller, that the OS talks to, might actually move around data on the hard drive in order to work around parts of the spinning disk which have failed to work anymore, which now no longer hold that magnetically encoded data. We also talked about solid-state disks, which were basically an attempt to provide the same interface that we're used to when solid-state disks were being made with hard drives, but with this completely different technology of flash. And we learned that flash, like, we didn't have these physical limitations in terms of needing something to actually move to a correct location, so it's a lot faster. But it had its own little quirks. And the biggest one was this idea of erasure blocks. That we had to erase large areas of the flash and rewrite it once. This was a limitation on we couldn't just rewrite a little piece at a time like we could with this, but also that we could only erase so many times before the erasure block would fail, and this went against the strategy we were previously using to use hard drives, where we'd often rewrite the same part of the hard drive over and over again. An example of that in the FAT file system is the FAT we change all the time, so we're going to rewrite that a lot. And that would be actually very bad for a solid-state disk if it used a direct mapping. So we had this layer of indirection, sort of the same kind of idea of remapping, that we'd move data to a new block whenever it was written in order to spread out the load among all the erasure blocks. And we'd have to do this procedure to garbage collect things that, eventually so we could free up space, even though we couldn't actually free up a whole erasure block at a time without moving some data around. So then we talked about how inode-based file systems worked. And this inode idea was that all the data about the file, and except the file name, was stored in one place. So in fact, we kind of spread it out. We had some of the stuff in the directory entry, we had some of the information in the FAT itself to like get the list of clusters. In the inode, we were gonna put all of that in this inode structure, and we'd have an array of these on the disk, and directory entries would just give an index into that array. And so this keeps all the data for a file together, should be more convenient to read and write. And we had this sort of limitation there. So one thing is that in the FAT, we kind of grouped together where we were storing what clusters were in a file with what clusters were free. Here we have to subtract that separately, but that's not too bad. We just had a separate part of the disk storing that information. And we also need to deal with, well, if I have a fixed-sized array, that means my inodes are fixed-sized, but they might need to store a variable number of blocks. How do we take care of that? We need to allocate extra space to know where the data is. And our solution was these indirect and double indirect block pointers. So we have the first few block pointers in the inode, and if that wasn't enough, we'd allocate a block for more block pointers, but it would all be pointed to by this inode, and that would be how we would find it. And that's where we left off last time. So before I move on and finish up a little talking about these indirect blocks, any questions about things we covered last time? So, indirect blocks might seem kind of complicated versus that sort of linked list approach we were using with the FAT, but usually this is considered a better idea. Even though like it seems like it's more complicated, and it is. So one advantage is because we have these direct blocks in the inode for small files, and we'll talk later today that small files are actually very, very common. There's lots of them. We don't need any space beyond the inode. So we aren't allocating extra space. So in some senses, usually we aren't using the indirect blocks. Usually you don't have that complication. Usually it's just an array. So that's great. And larger files are the one where we have more indirection. So with FAT, we kind of like pay this indirection cost for every file. With indirect blocks, we have this indirection cost, but we only pay it for the files which are big enough that, well, we probably have to do something complicated anyways, and we have so much data to read and write that maybe we can hide the extra time we're spending compared to like how complicated it's going to be to read and process a big file. The other thing is, if you think about how this structure works out, we have sort of log n-like time, because it's kind of like a tree structure. We can think of it as sort of we have the inode, and we have our direct pointers, then we have our indirect and our double indirect. So this is kind of like a tree, which is kind of lopsided. So tree. So we get sort of tree-like access times, but we have sort of an advantage for smaller files that they're even better than the sort of general tree. But it's kind of like a lopsided tree, so we get sort of log n times versus linear. So that's sort of why they sort of settled on this design when they were making the original Unix file systems. Okay. So if we think about everything we talked about for XV6, it has some nice pros versus FAT. So one pro is that we have better reliability. We'll talk about that later today. Scanning for free blocks is possibly easier because our free block map, because it's a dedicated structure, we can encode information about each block with one bit, which means that it should be faster to scan. We don't have to check for zeros over a whole integer. We can read less data to find a free block. It's easier to find the location of a particular block of a file. And this is very important for the sort of Unix way of using files with like the page cache, where we typically, aren't actually reading sequentially internally. Like that's not what the interface to the code that implements the file system is going to say. It's going to be more like, hey, get this block now. Oh, get the next block. But we're not going to have that explicit connection because of things like the page cache. So it's pretty easy to find a location of a block with a number because we either know it's this direct block pointer, or if it involves indirect blocks or double indirect blocks, we know, oh, it's block number 1000. That's the indirect pointer. Then go to the indirect block and go to entry, 993. We can compute that. So that's relatively easy to do, get to a particular part of the file, unlike FAT, where we have to traverse a linked list. And also, our file type and size information is held with the block locations, which is actually sort of makes more sense if we consider how we want to modify files. So if I want to append to a file, I want to write new block numbers and a new size, we do that all in one location. So that sort of makes more sense. Now, there are some sort of missing pieces from XV6, which are kind of performance issues. And we're going to look at a couple of these. So one of that, I'll just talk about them first, and then we'll go through solutions to selected ones of these. We're not going to have time, probably, to talk about all of them. So one issue is that if we remember the layout in the XV6 file system, we had sort of our header, we had our inodes, we had our free block map, and then we had our data. And this means that our inodes are up here, but the data for a file might be way down here. So they're stored far apart, which means we have long seek times. Remember, with a hard drive, we wanted to have things close together. So it seems like the XV6 file system is being systematically bad at this. That that even if we're relatively clever about how we allocate space in this data region, when the disk has enough stuff on it, we just can't find blocks near where the inodes are. And we're going to have these long seek times when we're reading the inode and its data. Or writing the inode and the data for it. Another issue is that we're having, you know, sort of bad choice of file and directory blocks. So XV6 chooses the first ones, but if you think about scattered about, you know, if, e.g., we delete small files. So if we delete a bunch of small files and then we write a big file, we're going to fill all those holes with those small files, most likely, and that's sort of going to scatter our data about. We're not going to keep blocks together. Okay. So these are, you know, about our, we have our, where our inodes are, and the actual choice XV6 rates for what to allocate isn't very clever, and that could, you know, mean that we have long seek times. So both of these are big seek times. So our next issue here, I'm talking about the blocks are pretty small. So we have this sort of trade-off. So if we make the blocks bigger, then we're going to use less space for metadata. The reason we're using space for metadata now is we need block pointers for each block. So you can think of this as that we're spending 2 bytes per a 512 byte block, at least. We might be spending more if we have indirect block pointers and so on. Now, we could say, okay, solution to this problem, why are we using 512 bytes? We can lower this overhead by making that bigger. But then we have sort of the opposite problem, that we're wasting space for small files, that we're going to have a lot of files which are only like a kilobyte. If we make our blocks 4 kilobytes, now we allocate a 4 kilobyte block, stick a 1 kilobyte file in it, and waste 3 kilobytes. So we kind of have this problem in XV6, that either we're wasting lots of space for block pointers, not wasting, but we're using a lot more space than it seems like we really need, especially for a very large file and that type of design, or we're going to be having a, you know, small files that waste lots of space because we allocate a whole block for them but can't use it. So another issue that you might notice we have in FAT and XV6 is that when we want to actually find a file in a directory, we have to scan the entire directory until we find it. So if the file's not there, we have to read through every single directory entry. And this is not particularly efficient. And there are ways, where I'm not sure we'll get to them, but there are ways we can imagine storing a directory with a, you know, tree-like, you know, the solution is a tree-like way to store directories. But that's going to be a little more complicated to manage, and we're going to have to do something a little different than the trees we're used to handle how the hard drive works and make it so we don't, like, do lots and lots of little reads, which is not something the hard drive is good at. Or a solid state disk is good at, for that matter. So questions about these performance issues. So if not, I'm going to move on to talk about a particular file system in the history of Unix, which solved some of these problems, basically did something that's a better solution to these first three issues. So we're going to look at what those are. And this file system is known as the Berkeley Fast File System. So this was sort of, they started with a Unix file system like XV6, and they said, that isn't very good. And they made this new version they called the Fast File System that kind of solves some of these problems. And this is rather influential. For example, Linux's Extended 2 file system was based on the Fast File System. So we'll look at what some things the FAT file system did to solve these first two issues. And it's going to solve these sort of in a related way. So one issue here is that the inode and block data is stored far away from the file data. So we're going to look at how we solve that first. And that's going to be sort of our key insight is going to be how do we, move the inode and block data such that this works, such that we can keep it close to the file data. And the reason this was a problem before is that we said we had one part of the disk for the inode data and one part for the data, and the disk is very big. Well, the data is most of the disk. Of course, some part of that data region needs to be far away from the inodes. So our solution is going to be to kind of divide up the disk into pieces and sort of lay each of those pieces out like a sort of mini file system. So we're going to divide up the disk into what we'll call block groups. So we're going to still have one header, but we're going to have a block group which has a part of the free map for these data blocks and the part of the inode array. And we can kind of look at this like a mini file system. So each of these block groups. Now, we don't actually want to treat this like a mini file system, because if you look at this approach, you're going to come up with some problems if these are actually sort of mini file system. So one issue is we need a header. Well, we're only going to have one header because this is all one file system. A bigger issue is, what if I need to store a file that's very big and is more data than fits in here? What do I do about that? And the answer is, well, that's not going to actually be a problem. We're going to prefer that inodes in this part of the disk only use data here, but we're not going to require that. So if the file is too big, that's fine. It can have data over here too. And the way we're going to make this work is we're going to kind of split up our indexes for blocks and inodes between these block groups. So for example, I might have decided each block group gets 1,024 inodes. So rather than having an inode array with many thousands of inodes altogether, I'm going to have each block group have 1,024 inodes, and we'll number the first 0 through 1,023. We'll number the second 1,024 through 2,047, and so on. And directory entries will have exactly the same format. They'll give an inode number, but when finding where inode 2000 is, we're going to have to take into account, that's in block group 2, that's over here. And we'll do something similar for data blocks. We'll say, rather than having data blocks be all together, when I see a block pointer in an inode, I'm going to say, you have a pointer to block 10,000, that's over here, doesn't matter what the inode is, inode that came from this. So the question is, what exactly is the difference between the inode and the block? So this is the, metadata for files plus block pointers at base of tree. So that's what's stored in our inodes, is the metadata for the file, except for the name. and the block pointers for the base of the tree. So this is where we're going to store our direct pointers and our top level direct pointers and our indirect pointers and so on at the top level, and sort of modification times and sizes and so on. The actual data, so this is this is the data for files is stored in the blocks here. Files, you know, and note that this is for directories. This is equals directory entries. For normal files, it's just the data you'd read. Does that answer your question? Yeah. So we have the same division we had in the x86 file system of the file metadata, root, the inodes, and the data being separate, but we divided up each of those into these pieces. So now that we have these in these pieces, and I mentioned that in the worst case, we can have an inode in this inode array have a pointer to a block over here. That's fine. But obviously, we want to avoid doing that, because the idea is that usually we're going to achieve the property that inodes over here use blocks over here, and inodes over here use blocks over here, that everything stays together. And the way that the fast file system chose to do this is that they assign directories to a block group, and they try to keep the directory entries and the inodes for files in that directory and the data for files in that directory in one block group. Now, sometimes this isn't going to work because we'll run out of room in the block group, but this is sort of the goal and what we'll usually manage. And so what we hope will happen after we do this is that each directory will be contained within one block group. So we've kind of minimized our seek time because we never have to go beyond the end of a block group, and that's going to be on a hard drive physically close together. But we have this fallback that we can still point to from any inode to any block number, no matter what group it's in. So for large files, we can like split it up. So here, you know, we have a big file.txt. It's really big. Well, it starts in the block group for its directory, but if we need more blocks, we'll just find them elsewhere, and that's okay. So questions about this strategy here. So the question is, how big would these block groups be? I do not know offhand what the actual sizes modern versions of this use. Sorry, I would have to look that up. Other questions? So now that we know about block groups, let's talk about this second problem of having a bad choice of file and directory data blocks. So we're making our choice better because we're at least putting it in the right block group. And what the fast file system does for writing the data is that it does the same strategy that XV6 uses of just taking the first thing that's free, but in the block group that we're supposed to write the file, assuming there's still space. And this is a diagram from our textbook about how this works. So this is what our block group will look like as far as what's free. And the reason why the authors of the fat file system thought that this would work out well is that they think that usually when we write a large file, we'll have little bits of it that are scattered at the beginning, but most of it will end up being in some contiguous big free space. That's the theory. This depends, of course, on how is the file system actually used. So it's not guaranteed that it will work out this way, but their hope is that usually the free blocks will have a big space at the end and little holes in the before, and will fill in the little holes first in the big parts, afterwards, and we'll end up having most of large files be contiguous. That's sort of their theory. You could imagine that if you didn't believe that that would be typically how people would use files and end up freeing them, that maybe you'd do some other allocation strategy. But because of this, they think that usually we'll end up with files being mostly contiguous or close to contiguous so we can read them quickly. A key part of why they thought they could make this assumption, and something that kind of earlier file systems weren't doing, is that they're relying on there being a bunch of free space. So part of the notion about that, why this would work, is that they're assuming you never make your disk more than 90% full. And increasingly, that has become an actually reasonable assumption. And it makes it easier to like have these simple strategies like this usually work out. Because if usually we have a bunch of free space on the disk, usually there's going to be this long, trails of free space that we end up with. So the overall strategy they used for assigning block groups here, so just written out, I didn't talk about how do we decide what directory goes to a block group. There, the way the FAT file system did is that when we make a subdirectory in a directory, we just choose a new block group for it. And that's sort of how we end up assigning new block groups. And so their notion here is that hopefully the files in one directory are things you want to access together, which seems like a pretty good intuition, even though it is a guess about how you want to use those files. And when we write a file, we just choose the same block group as the directory, and we use the first free block. And they keep the disk deliberately underutilized, so hopefully there's long runs of blocks at the end of every block group, and we don't have like only little holes to fill. And something about their allocation strategy, which makes this avoid making files non-contiguous, is that you notice here in this picture, we're saying we write a whole two-block file altogether, or we write a large file altogether. So part of what they did is that they made sure that when they were interacting with the page cache and so on, that they would try to delay writing the file until they had an idea about how big it was, so they could allocate all the blocks of the file together. And that meant that when they were, even though they were taking the first one free, they were doing this, after most of the file's data was available and they knew how much to allocate. So we didn't like have the issue of if you're writing two files at once, their blocks would be interleaved. We'd sort of separate them out, assuming we could cache enough. So this is versus the sort of naive strategy would be, once I add a new block to the page cache, allocate the block on disk. In fast file system, they delayed that. Don't allocate the block on disk until we actually need to write it to disk in order to try to allocate more things together. So questions about block groups? So block groups did something which should mitigate both this sort of distance between our metadata and our data, and also our distance between data for different files in the same directory. So should give us better performance on hard drives, and also allow us to have more things that are contiguously stored or approximately contiguously stored, so we have lower seek times when reading a file and its metadata, and when reading different parts of the same file. Now, we have the second issue about like block size. So blocks are small in XV6, so we're using a lot of space for metadata, and you might say, okay, let's just make them bigger, and a reason we don't do that is because then we'd have small files waste a lot of space. And this would be a big problem. And this is not obvious, because when you think of storing files, you usually think of big files. The ones that, like, really matter if you lose them or are hard to store. But people have looked at what do people actually use file systems for. So there's been a bunch of studies of this. So here's a graph from a 2000 paper. Sorry, I don't have something substantially newer. But they got a bunch of sort of workloads from different kind of corporate-like or academic environments. And they looked at, well, how big were the files people are using? And this chart is a CDF. So what that means is that on our y-axis is a percentage, and our x-axis is a file size, note the log scale. And we can read this as here, this point, that in the web workload, 20% of the files were smaller than 1K. In the res workload, 65% of the files about were smaller than 1K, and so on. Or if we look at 10K, we can say, okay, in the, you know, this is the NT workload, about a little more than 70% of the files were smaller than 10K. So that's how you read this chart. And the big thing that comes across is that it's pretty common for most of the files to be smaller than 1 kilobyte. And, you know, even the bigger ones usually aren't that much bigger. And most of the files being smaller than 1 kilobyte means that the proposition of saying, okay, 512 bytes is too small, you know, I don't want to store thousands of pointers for a megabyte file, so let's choose a bigger size like 4K. Well, that sounds great until you look at this and you say, okay, so now I have, you know, 50% of my files I'm going to be storing with three times as much space as the actual data they contain. Yeah, that's sort of the what you'd be doing. And that means that you'd end up, you know, leaving a lot of your disk unavailable to store actual things you care about. So we kind of want this sort of compromise where we really do want to store, you know, small pieces of files as our unit we store things on disk, but we don't want to store large files this way because of how these typical file sizes work, that we have most of these files are pretty small and there's lots of them. That doesn't mean we don't care about large files because they take up most of the space on our disk. And, you know, we don't want reading large files to be slow because we have to retrieve lots of pointers, or writing them to be slow because we have to update lots of block pointers, allocate lots of blocks. So we still want larger blocks for large files to have good performance, but it really matters how we deal with these small files, and we really don't want to allocate 4K for a 1K file. You know, we might be okay allocating, you know, 1K for a 800 byte file. You know, that's at least not nearly so wasteful, but not these big wastes that we'd end up doing in order to make the large files not have a lot of overhead. So the fast file system had a solution to this problem. And their idea basically was that they would divide up blocks into smaller pieces. So the rule was that the last block of a file could be what they called a fragment. And they would split each block into four fragments and give each fragment its own index. And they'd have an extra field in the inode saying, hey, this block, this file has a fragment. And the idea that then is that you could, you know, use one block to store data for several small files this way. But still your block pointers, you know, would not, you know, change for large files. So we have this extra field in the inode. Another thing we need, you know, plus, you know, free block map becomes a free fragment map. So we'd have, we'd store not just is each block free, we'd store is each fragment free. So we had a little extra metadata, but our large files didn't have, had less metadata because this allows us to have bigger blocks and not be disappointed by that. Okay, so questions about fragments? Large files, same thing. We just, but we can choose larger block sizes without being unhappy. Now, you can say, okay, this allows you to make your blocks bigger, but this still seems kind of disappointing for a large file. Like, if we think about like a gigabyte file, you know, even if we make our blocks, you know, 4K or 16K, we still have hundreds of thousands of them to store. And that means if we want to read the file, we have to read hundreds of thousands of block numbers, then can pass those back to the disk in order to read the file. That seems awfully annoying and slow and time-consuming. You know, can we do better than that? And the answer is yes, but FFS didn't bother. In FFS, you have a gigabyte file, you're going to have, you know, many thousands of block pointers still. But more recent file systems, especially as larger files have become more common, have done some special treatment, you know, that's particularly good for these larger files. So we're going to talk about some things that these more recent file systems do. And examples is Microsoft's NTFS and Linux's Extended 4 have a special technique to help mitigate large files having giant list of blocks, you know, which we learn still is going to happen even if we make the block size larger, because we're not going to make it large enough so a multi-gigabyte file isn't composed of lots of blocks. If we do that, then, you know, we're going to waste a lot of space for even modestly sized files. So what we're going to do for this is something we're going to call extents. And the observation here is that really, if we're storing a big file, we'd like to store it contiguously anyways. So what we'd like our list of blocks to look like is that we'd like have like, you know, 1000, 1001, 1002, 1003, you know, ideal, you know, block pointer list would be that. So why don't we just store instead, 1000 and, you know, number instead of this ideal list. So, you know, what we're replacing a list with every block with this list of blocks starting at 1000 going for the next, you know, 500 blocks all together. So provided that we can allocate the file in one big chunk, this means we only store two numbers and not one number for each block. Okay. And we can do this instead of a list of block pointers. So this is something that Linux's Extended 4 and Windows NTFS both support and try to use at least for large files. Now, there's an obvious challenge here, which is that previously we were kind of saying, well, usually we'll get contiguous blocks, but often we'll have exceptions. And now if we want to use this strategy, we're saying you need to find contiguous blocks. If you don't have them, well, you can't do it. And that seems bad because, you know, sometimes, well, we're going to have our disk, we're going to have data like here and here and here, and I want to allocate a file that's this big. There's nowhere I can put it altogether. And even if there is, like, how do I find that? So one thing is that we are going to change how we allocate blocks to files. But the other thing is we're going to have a fallback, and our fallback is that we're going to have a list of these extents. So if we don't have just one chunk, we're going to store a list of those chunks. This should still be more compact because we can still find contiguous chunks that are pretty big. So for a big file, like a gigabyte file, maybe we store it in like a bunch of 100 megabyte segments. That's still a list of 10 things, not many tens of thousands. Now, for finding the blocks, we can't use the first in block group strategy because the first several blocks are going to be these little holes. And if we're storing those as extents, that's going to be pretty inefficient. So as an example of a different allocation strategy, NTFS like actually scans the block map to find what they call the best fit. They find the contiguous chunk of blocks that is closest in size and can fit the file we're trying to allocate. And if they don't find one, they're going to split it up into pieces in some way. This means that allocating the file blocks is a lot more complicated, but this is a cost you might be willing to pay because now reading and writing the file after you do this is going to be a lot simpler. So questions about extents. Now, extents have a big disadvantage if we're compared to block pointers, which kind of makes them more complicated. So not only is allocation more complicated to if you want to efficiently use your extents, you don't want to have a giant list. Also, like seeking is more complicated. So with block pointers, I could say, okay, I want to go a megabyte into the file. How do I do that? Well, I know that's, you know, 1,000 blocks. I know the 1,000th block pointer is in the first indirect block at index whatever. I compute that, do a pinpoint to the disk, reads to the disk. With extents, we kind of need to scan a list of extents, assuming there's more than one. So like, we don't want to have a big list, that seems inefficient. There are solutions that can make this more efficient, but it's gonna be a lot more complicated than finding a particular part of something stored with block pointers. Okay. So now that we've talked a bit about sort of these two alternative file layouts, let's ask this question. And hopefully I did this math right. I see what I did here. I'm looking at my quiz answer. So let's look at this question. I will update the quiz quickly to have answers that actually make sense and I don't show to you. So start working on this and right. Okay. Yeah, let me edit this question to actually correspond to what I intended to ask, which is that we'll say each directory contains 2 4-meg files. Or Yeah, we'll say each directory contains two before-meg files and work from there. And see what how you do. I did some math earlier and didn't double check my math until now. So when I was computing the options, I'd like to be in the right range. So we have, remember, this is a file system, you know, that uses inodes. So first question is, how many inodes are used? Give you some time to think about this. I have slides I prepared, but the numbers are wrong because I messed up the options that I, well, numbers are wrong because of one place where I was editing this question. Yes, you are supposed to answer all three. We'll go over them all together. Yeah, and I do expect this to take a bit of time. I'll give another minute or so. I know not that many have answered, but presumably you've most at least started. And you can work on the rest as we go over it. Okay, so I'll stop now. You can obviously, you can look at, you can see that we don't have consensus. So that is a thing. I'll go over first how many inodes are used. So I've edited the question, so I'll need to edit my explanation slides. So we have six files in each, five files in each subdirectory. And we also need an inode for the subdirectory. Remember, directories are a special type of file. It's just rather than their data being stuff that a program reads, their data is directory entries. So each of the two subdirectories needs six. So that gives us with 12 for the subdirectories. Plus the root directory, it contains directory entries. We need to have pointers to those directory entries. So it has its own inode. So that gives us 13. So the key thing is that every file needs an inode. Directories are files. The root directory is not an exception in these inode-based file systems. So questions about how I came up with this. So so let's look at the case with fragments. So a tricky thing with this is that we need to think of, well, how do we store each of the, you know, our files? So first we have to worry about these small files. We have these three 512 byte files in each subdirectory, so we have six of those. And each of those is going to use one fragment. And you might say, gosh, we're only using half the fragment. Couldn't we stash two of these files together? The answer is no, sorry, you can't. The reason we can't is that we're not storing information about how fragments are used in a granular enough way to divide them up. If we wanted to do that, we need to make smaller fragments, which means we need to store more information about what fragments are in use, so there's a trade-off. Now, the subdirectories have directory entries, and something that you might miss is that we need to store the subdirectories' directory entries somewhere, and that's gonna be a lot less than 1 kilobyte, so it's gonna fit in a fragment. So the best thing to do is to store each of those in a fragment. And similarly, the root directory has directory entries. The best thing to do is to store that in a fragment. So the best we could do is we have nine fragments, six for the small files, and three for the directory entries. And that's going to give us, you know, three blocks that we'll allocate and use fragments of. Then we have to worry about the large files. So we have these 4 meg files, and these 4 meg files use 1,024 data blocks. And if we go back here, we had 12 direct pointers in our inode. So the first 12, you know, so the first 12 times 4 KB uses the direct pointers. But after that, we need to use a block of indirect pointers. And it turns out that each indirect block stores 1,024 pointers. So how did I get 1,024? So I have 4 KB blocks divided by 4 byte pointers equals 1,000 pointers, 1,024 pointers. Now, even though we need 1,024 data blocks, remember, the first 12 are stored in the inode itself with direct pointers, so we're not actually going to use the whole indirect block, but we still need to allocate the whole block. We can't, like, do better than that. So if I correct my math here, this is, we have 4,096 blocks for the data that we can't use. So I'll get to your question in a bit. For the data of the files that are stored in whole blocks, we have 4 blocks for the indirect pointers to support that, and we have 3 blocks to store fragments for both file data and directory data, which gives us 4,102 blocks, assuming I didn't make a math error. So your question is, so the direct pointers aren't used if indirect pointers are usable? That's not what happens here. So our 4-meg file, we have our inode for the 4-meg file, and we have a bunch of indirect pointers, and those are all used and point to the file's data. But we run out of them. So when we run out of them, we have our indirect block, and that points to the rest of the data. But we didn't need all of this indirect block, so the bottom of it, you know, last part of this, that's what's unused. Does that answer your question? So basically, direct pointers are only used if all indirect pointers are used up. Precisely the opposite. Direct pointers are used first, then the indirect pointer, then the double indirect pointer, and so on. So in this case, I had 12 direct pointers in my inode. That's where the beginning of the file is. And then I ran out of space using those direct pointers, so I used an indirect pointer to point to more block numbers, and that's where the remainder of the file was in this case. And it turned out, when I used this extra block of pointers, I didn't need all of them, so the last part of that was unused. And this is even though, you know, wasn't clever and didn't like decide, oh, I'm using indirect pointers, I might as well put the whole thing there. No, I mechanically say, try to use direct pointers until they fill up, then go to the indirect pointer, then we're gonna go, if we had an even bigger file, we go to the double indirect pointer, and so on. And the question is, did I do math wrong? Isn't this sum supposed to be 4,100? And the answer is absolutely. Okay, other questions? So why do we need one indirect block? So if I only use direct pointers in my inode, maybe I have a blank slide. So if I only use direct pointers, why do we need one indirect block? So this is my inode here. I have file info, file meta info, and I have direct one, two, and so on. Then I have an indirect, then I have a 2x indirect, and so on. So if I was storing a number of blocks of data up into the size, we need that. So here, you know, this is the first number direct times block size bytes. So that handles the first, in this case, our number of direct was 12 times 4k, and this is 36 kilobytes. So then I needed to use more space. So I move on to my indirect pointer, and this points to one block. Block with 4K, and that's 1,024 pointers. So I'm going to need to fill up these pointers. And if I count each of these pointers, and this is the next number of pointers times block size bytes. And we have 1K pointers here times a 4K block. So this is the next 4 megabytes. So in this case, I need to store a 4 meg file. So the first 36K is here. And then I start using this indirect block. I don't need all of it, and that's okay. And if we had, say, a bigger file, we go to this double indirect block where we'd have a block with 4K, with, you know, 1,024 pointers, that points to a block with those number of pointers. And this would be, this block here would be our next 4 megabytes. And the next block it points to would be the next 4 megabytes after that, and so on. So that's what we'd do if we did still needed more space. So hopefully that clears things up. So remember, we had this structure that we're filling out. So basically what happened here is I got down this far on the list, and that's why I needed one indirect block. But I could have gone, if I had a bigger file, I'd go further. So then we have a question that I did not actually prepare a slide. How about this if we have extents? So let's think about how this works for extents. So in that case, each subdirectory, you know, we're gonna allocate one block for each of these. So let's do C here. So we have 512 byte files are going to be one block. So we're going to store them with an extent. The extent is going to say starting block number size of one each. So that means six blocks for the 512 byte files. The 4 meg files, we're going to allocate 1,024 blocks each. So for the total two subdirectories times two, we're going to allocate 4,096 blocks. Plus we need a block for the, you know, plus three blocks for the directories. So I say, you know, the directories, sub plus root, we have three directories, we have three blocks total. And so that gives us a total of 4,096 plus six is 1,102, so 4,105 blocks. And we don't need any blocks for block pointers, assuming we can get the minimum here, and the minimum assumes one extent per file. So extents only give us savings with huge files. So we can technically get savings with smaller files if we were like using them in combination with fragments in some way, yes. But the reason I didn't have savings with smaller files is more about this no fragments part. So we'd like want to combine these features to support small files well. But yes, extents, like the biggest savings we got was on these 4 meg files, and it would be even more substantial without that. And this is a savings both in storage and in how complex it is to get to a particular part of that 4-mega file. And this is assuming the best case that we can actually allocate contiguous parts. Okay, so questions on this exercise in general. Okay, so that's, so let's talk a bit about reliability. So we're going to talk about, there's multiple kinds of reliability we can be concerned about. We're going to be mostly talking about what happens if there's a crash. And our key tool we're going to use to sort of limit what can happen in this case is that we're going to say that hard drives are going to either write the whole disk sector or corrupt it. So writing a sector, you know, is in a sense atomic. So if the write's interrupted, we'll learn. We aren't going to get a case where a sector is partially written. The way hard drives are going to do this is they have a checksum for each sector. So we either wrote the sector or we didn't. And the reason why I'm going to talk about this is because writing sectors is atomic, but most of our file system updates aren't one sector. And we're going to be concerned about, well, is the file system in a consistent state? There's some other topics we won't talk about much related to reliability. We're just going to be concerned about, is the file system consistent? For example, do I know what blocks are free? I don't want to be confused. I don't want to think a block is free, but a file's using it. Or I don't want to think a block isn't free, but no file's using it, so I can never use that space. Do I know what files exist? Are we not confused about, you know, like how many files there are, you know, whether an inode is used but never not accessible, and so on. And this is actually tricky because we divide up information we care about in multiple places. So let's think about renaming a file on the XV6 file system. Let's say I want to rename a file, move it from one directory to another. Not just rename, remove from one directory to another. I have two steps here. So my first step is I'm going to overwrite a new directory entry. My second step is I'm going to overwrite the old directory entry. And this kind of creates a problem because these are two separate updates to different sectors. So if we have a crash, we have a problem like what happened. So let's say I do A before B and then while I'm trying to do this, a crash happens, I lose power, something goes wrong after I do A. Well, that's going to be a problem because now I have two pointers to the same file. And if the old directory entry is removed later, so let's say I come back after this crash, I type, I thought I moved that file, IRM it. That's going to be really bad because then I'm going to actually delete the file that we still have a pointer to. And we don't ever want to do that. Like that, then we're going to like lose data and something weird, very weird is going to happen. So you might say, okay, well, you just did this in the wrong order. Why don't we do B then A? And that's worse. Because then if a crash happens after B, then we root the system up after the crash. We look for the file. It's not anywhere. So that's probably worse. You probably wouldn't be happy about that. Okay. And this is like a really simple case. We just have two updates and both of our answers are kind of crappy. And this gets worse when we think about other operations. So let's say we're creating a new file. When we create a new file, we need to mark blocks as used, write the inode, write the directory entry. And if we think about orders we can do this in, if we do A first and then have a crash, well, now we've marked blocks as used, but they're really free. If we do B, then we have an inode. That is used, but it's not really used. We're wasting inodes. We'll eventually run out if this keeps happening. If we do C first, Then we have a direct reentry that points to junk after we reboot from the crash. So XV6 has a fix to avoid this problem. And you might say, well, how do we avoid this problem given that, well, there's no order we could choose, like, and we have to update all these parts of the disk. And our solution is going to be that we're going to choose an update that actually does the operation. That is going to be one sector being updated is going to say this file was moved or this file exists. And we're going to have a generic strategy for doing this. And this is going to involve some indirection and some extra stuff we'll do when we reboot to make sure we're making that work. And the key idea is that we're going to group updates into what we'll call a transaction. And what we're going to do when we have this group of updates is we're going to decide that one update is going to say this transaction is what we'll call committed, meaning it must happen. And logically, if that update's there, the transaction happened. If it's not there, we're going to ignore all the partial operations somehow. And I'll talk about how can we ignore them in a bit. And our key idea is that we're going to do what we'll call redo logging. I'll tell you why it's redo in a bit, but it's based on logging. So what we're going to do is we're going to log what we want to do before we do it. So when I'm writing to a file, making a new file, I'm going to not actually update this part of the disk yet. I'm going to write a log on the disk, some other part of the disk, saying, hey, I'm about to do this transaction, this set of grouped operations, where I'm going to update a directory entry, update some data blocks for the file, update an inode, and update the free block map in this way. And we're going to write out in the log exactly what we're planning on doing. Then I'm going to write something to the log saying, I've committed to doing these operations. And what that is that's a promise to me later that I'm going to make sure these happen no matter what. And you may say, how are we going to do this? This is where the redo logging comes into place. That we're going to check this log later. For example, if we boot up after a crash, look for this commit message and do these operations again. We're going to redo them just in case they weren't actually done. Now, if we don't have a crash, we're also going to do these operations. So, you know, operations later. So that's the idea of these logs. With the more general logging idea, we might have multiple transactions in a log, and that's fine. And eventually, after we've logged something, we apply the operations to the disk. And once we've applied all those operations, we can free up space in the log. Because if we didn't do that, you'd say, well, now I'm just going to run out of space in the log. How do we free up space? We do all the operations, make sure they're done, then we can overwrite part of the log. So the overall way this works is normally the way we update a file now is we first write to the log what we want to do, write the log, I'm committed to doing this, then we do the updates, then we reclaim the space in the log after all the updates are done. And if we have a crash before we write this commit, we just say, okay, just forget about all that stuff I logged, I didn't get it done, so let's not worry about it. You know, we didn't move the file, we didn't create a new file, sorry. If we have a crash while we're doing these updates, that's fine. When we reboot, we're going to check this log and say, oh, there are these updates that might not be done, let's just do them just in case. So our recovery is we're going to read the log on reboot. So this is sort of reboot and redo any operation with a commit, and we're going to make sure we do it in a way where it's okay if we do it twice. And then we'll reclaim space in the log. So questions about this redo logging idea? So I think I'm out of time for today. So we'll finish this up next time and then talk about distributed systems a bit.